Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast for another look at the Bond books. And this time we're looking at books about Bond, not the Fleming novels themselves, but we've actually got the author with us, and he's a key author of discussing not just Bond films, but cinema and other media as well. We've got Mark Edlitz with us. So welcome to the show, Mark.
Hello. Very, very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're happy to have you, Mark, and it's been a long time coming, but we're finally ready to chat. In fact, it's been so long that Mark has written a book, I think, since the last time we might have tried to do this. So that shows you just how prolific the guy is and how committed he is to these topics. Yeah, so there are various places you can listen to our podcast. We're on YouTube, iTunes, and Spotify, and you can actually go on our PodDojo Network website and listen to us there. Thank you for sharing, rating, and recommending our episodes. We're also on social media, so you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Don't think we're on Threads yet, but that might be one to come. Anyway, special shout out tonight to Mr. Steve Corenteng, who is a huge fan of James Bond, and particularly the Timothy Dalton films, which I'm sure we'll get on to talk about, because there's a large section of one of Mark's books about the unmade Dalton films. Tonight with me, I'm joined by regular contributor John Kell, licensed to Kell. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Mark. Good evening, Steve. Great to be here.
Rob.
Hello there.
And I've also got another regular contributor, Mr. Steve Clamp. Good evening, Steve.
I've been promoted to regular contributor now. I feel special.
I think you've got to be, haven't you? Friend of the show. I know there's various titles you could have. But normally it's Steve is the one still having his meal, but John this time is still trying to finish it before we get... Anyway, not to embarrass him further, we will crack on. Yeah, it's great to have you, Mark. Just a sort of bit of background to yourself. How did you get into the world of writing, first of all?
I think I was looking for something to do. I went to film school and I made a movie or two. I made a documentary. I made a narrative feature film that I wrote and directed. And I also made a documentary on extreme Star Wars fans called Jedi Junkies. And I was thinking of something to do next that wouldn't require other people's permission. Meaning when you make a film... There's a lot of it's expensive. It's you're doing it with a lot of people, and it takes a long time, no matter how you do it, at least in my experience. So I was looking for something to do that I could sort of manage on my own. And the first book I wrote is called How to Be a Superhero. And that's interviews with actors who have played superheroes over the past 60 or 70 years. So that's interviews with your various Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and the Hulks and Daredevils and so on.
Amazing.
And for that, I interviewed the people you wouldn't necessarily expect for some of these, like the TV Spider-Man, Nicholas Hammond from the 70s, Adam West from the 60s.
Whoa.
All right, here we go.
Kevin Conroy, the Batman from the animated series.
Oh, yes.
So I try to go and find people whose stories weren't necessarily being told in other ways. That took a ridiculously amount of time. I wrote that over a 10-year period. I mean, I was doing other things with my life. But from the concept to publication, it was 10 years. And then while writing that book, How to Be a Superhero, I squeezed in James Bond. And I argued that James Bond is sort of like a superhero. He wears a tux instead of a cape. I don't know if I completely believe it, but I really wanted to write about James Bond. Yeah. And I figured no one was around to stop me.
Yeah.
So then I wrote a book about, then I realized I wanted to write about James Bond. So I wrote a book that became to be known as The Many Lives of James Bond. And when I handed that into my publisher, it was going to be something like 200,000 words, and they wanted 80,000, and they eventually gave me 100,000. But there was so much material and so much story that I had to really refine what I wanted for that book, Many Lives of James Bond. Mm. And what that book became was interviews with creatives in the James Bond movies and books, video games as well as interviews with actors who have played James Bond. So in addition to Roger Moore and George Lazenby, I also interviewed the Bond of the radio, the Bond of the video games,
yeah,
the Bond of the TV, James Bond Jr.
Yeah, still counts. Yeah.
It's still, it absolutely counts. And there's a lot of people who have played James Bond. I mean, I know that when I first think of James Bond, I think of the movie Bond. But I think it's also interesting that there's so many other people who have, quote unquote, officially played James Bond in various professional capacities.
Yeah. You spoke to Toby Stevens.
I spoke to him for my second book. He was one of those people that I couldn't, that I wanted to speak for Bond for radio, but wasn't able to get him in that book. And so I squeezed him into the second one.
Yeah.
But I did speak to the Bond actor who played Bond in the You Only Live Twice radio show. Wow. And I also found out more about Bob Holness, who played James
Bond.
Oh,
yeah.
In Moonraker. See, that thing about Moonraker, Bob Holness's Moonraker, is that it never made any sense to me that there was this odd floating James Bond story that was recorded in South Africa in the 1950s. And we didn't even have a date. But we did know that Bob Holness, who was known to many as a game show host,
Bond.
And I was able to find out a lot about his experience playing it, and as well as I was able to produce the contract that he signed to play the role, which included the dates of the performance, his rehearsal schedule, how much he was paid, which wasn't a lot. But it was important to me to provide some sort of context and understanding of what was going on there.
Yeah, as you might know, Mark, I work in TV over here in Britain, and the station I work for is ITV Central, and that is who used to make the game show that Bob Holness was very
famous. Yeah.
We've actually got an image of it on the wall at work. Blockbusters is what I'm doing for in this country. So it was years after, you know, we'd all seen him on the TV in the 80s that word started to get around that he had actually played James Bond, and he had a great voice for it, actually. He's got one of those, you know, almost, not quite Roger Moore, but you know, his great depth in his voice. But of course, none of us thought of him as an actor here. We all just knew him as a game show host with a catchphrase that he had here to go with it. But quite nice to know that I worked for the place that did employ James Bond at one time.
Yeah,
you absolutely did. And he was in a repertory company. So each week they would have a different radio adaptation. And Moonraker just happened to be that time up. You know, it was one of many.
love to hear those as well, wouldn't you? Goodness me.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it exists. Not certain that it was recorded, and you know, I believe it was not recorded. And even if it were recorded, it would have been the tape would have been recorded over. Like
Doctor
Who's are missing,
because
they recorded over to, you know, people didn't have an expectation that there would be an interest in these things beyond the live performance or maybe the repeated performance, but it was not meant to be something that was preserved, which is a shame, not just for James Bond and Moonraker, but for all these things.
That book particularly is almost an unanswered question, don't you? You don't know what they're going to say. And then you have the conclusions that you might draw as to what did they bring to the character of Bond and what are the different characteristics. And I've always said that it's gone beyond Fleming now, the character. The character he created, of course, is the literary Bond. But even that's been extended to the other books, the radio plays, and particularly the films. They're their own entities now. So it's not as simple as saying that's James Bond has to be this, he has to be that, because he had a scar and all this kind of stuff. It's a lot more diverse now, which I think is great.
Yeah, I agree with you. It took me the writing of that entire book, Many Lives of James Bond, to figure that out. I started with the idea that there's this character, James Bond, that Ian Fleming made, and that these books, comics, video games, radio plays were all almost direct extension of that original work. And obviously they wouldn't, none of these would have existed without Fleming.
Yeah.
But they are separate entities and sort of should be understood as that. There is not one Bond. There are many versions of Bond.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
And the medium in which you're telling the story impacts what version of Bond you're getting. In a narrative like a movie, you have more opportunity to show different aspects of his character. In a radio show, you're going to tone down the action a little bit,
and
get a little bit into his inner thoughts, which you need to do to tell the story, and wouldn't do in any other medium. And in a video game, or sometimes in a comic, you amp up the action because that's what the medium requires.
Absolutely, yeah. That's fascinating, isn't it?
Mark, obviously, I'm a big fan of your work, and also thank you for. I've had a look at the new book as well. Just outstanding stuff. And from a writing perspective, I wanted to ask a little bit about your process, if possible. Does the writing process? I mean, does it come naturally to you?
No,
really, no.
No. I'm just a hard worker. I work hard. I'm good at research. I'm inquisitive. I don't think I know more than my subjects, but I come prepared. I listen to what they say. I try to ask questions that they might not have asked before. But I work hard at it, and I write every day. Although I'm trying to just do it five times a day. Not five times a day, five times a
week. I was going
to
say. Wow.
I work in the mornings. I work at night. I work around work. I work one chapter at a time. And then when I put all the books, all the chapters together, and do one chapter at a time allows me to get it done because I could just focus on one thing.
Wow. Was it always a plan that you would like to write books, or was it just something that you kind of stumbled into?
No, I'm a failed writer, director.
Oh, no. No, I disagree with this.
I'm enjoying it, though. I really like it. I think it's fun. I'm grateful when anybody takes the time to read my work, whether they like it or not. I'd prefer it if they would like it. But these books take, the first one took 10 years. The second one took 2 or 3 years. The other one took 2 or 3 years. The fourth one took 2 or 3 years. It takes a while to make for me to write a book. So I just hope people, go on Amazon and pick one up.
Oh, man.
When you were growing up, though, how did you get into Bond? And who was your favorite Bond growing up?
Growing up, it was my original and first Bond is Roger Moore, or was Roger Moore.
Yeah.
And I always think that your first Bond is sort of like your first love, or like a bird who sees, who imprints on the first thing that they see, allegedly. And so Roger Moore was my version of Bond. And when I first saw Moonraker in 1979, I greatly preferred Roger Moore to Sean Connery, and I didn't even like Sean Connery at that time. I wasn't a smart kid, but in terms of Sean Connery, I didn't like him at the time. And so then after Moonraker was For Your Eyes Only, which what I love about that combo of Moonraker and For Your Eyes Only is that Moonraker is over the top Bond in Space, and For Your Eyes Only is a gritty thriller. And it showed me that at an early age that there doesn't have to be one kind of Bond story. They don't all have to be one flavor, different flavors for different times. And I think that's helped its longevity.
You missed, Mr. Bond. Did I? As you said, such good sport.
Just to back up what you were saying then, Mark, when I was a kid, you know, we get all our Bond films here on the ITV network. They regularly show them, still have this day, and they would premiere them when they were the premieres. And for me as a kid, it was always Roger Moore. I would put a Bond film on, not knowing which actor it was going to be. And then if I saw it was Roger Moore, I think, oh, brilliant, it's one of the fun ones. And if it was Sean Connery, I'd be, oh, there's not going to be so much action, it's going to be so much fun. And that was really, as a kid, all I saw, obviously. My views have, I still utterly adore Roger Moore, but my views have changed as I've got older about Sean Connery. But as a kid, very similar to your thoughts.
That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So when this book came out, Mark, did you have lots of people sort of coming in and getting in touch with you to sort of say, I agree with you or I don't agree with them and things like that?
I was really worried while writing the book. I was afraid that Bond fans would tear it apart, that they would reject the premise, that if I said that Bond if Bond likes a nice hamburger, not that, that people would be like, no, he hates hamburger, he loves cheeseburgers or whatever. I completely misjudged the community. My people's reaction to it, even if they don't agree with every point that I make, nor should they, has been they've been very lovely and kind and embraced me, which was quite a relief, because I honestly did live in fear for a couple of years that the whole book would be savaged.
We found that, to be fair. There's the occasional sort of defensiveness on Twitter. Mm. If you praise Pierce Brosnan too much or something like that, people get a bit annoyed, but overall, the community or the fan base is a lot more positive and welcoming than certain other franchises, which I'm sure you might have found in your book about the four films in franchises. Name no name Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did a documentary on extreme Star Wars fans called Jedi Junkies. There was a guy, and so they're extreme fans, and so there was a guy who built a life-size Millennium Falcon in his backyard.
Wow.
it's kind of brilliant, right?
Yeah.
And he built the structure on a toy that had three pieces of landing gear. But that is not stable. And when he built it to scale, he found that three wasn't enough and that the real Millennium Falcon would have had more. And a terrible wind blew it over, and then he had to torch the whole thing. Pretty cool.
I don't want to go off on movies go forth at the moment, because we're going to talk a little bit about that at the end. But just while you mention it, and Star Wars, as you did, Tom, I don't know if you guys have had a chance to read it yet, but do you know what the fourth Star Wars film actually is?
Well, the controversy is it A New Hope?
Because that's the point.
You've not even got that. What's the what would you say is the other option for the fourth? Don't come in here, Mark. Yet.
Well, I've not read the, but it's not the holiday special, is it?
Well, it could be Rogue One, could it?
No, not interesting. You're all wrong.
Even that,
all
wrong.
It's the Ewok Adventure.
Oh, right, yes.
In a galaxy far, far away, a brother and sister search for their missing parents.
How are we going to find them?
We will. Don't worry.
And fate leads them to the magical Ewoks.
We help you.
Now, a great adventure begins. It's an action-packed motion picture featuring incredible special effects from the award-winning team of Industrial Light and Magic.
That's Mommy and Daddy.
Sometimes when you search for the impossible, an unbelievable adventure unfolds.
I wish we had furry creatures like you where I came from.
Don't miss The Ewok Adventure, now on video cassette from MGM UA Home Video.
There's a good reason for it. Okay. So the question, like, lots of times what's the fourth movie is obvious. Yeah. The fourth James Bond is Thunderball. The fourth modern Batman is Batman and Robin. The fourth Superman is Superman 4. And a lot of times they'll put the number in the title to clear up any confusion. With Star Wars, I thought it was a fun question because, well, what is the fourth Star Wars film? Well, the first Star Wars film was titled Episode 4 when it was re-released. And then what most people think of this fourth Star Wars film, The Phantom Menace, is titled Episode 1.
Yeah.
But immediately after Return of the Jedi, George Lucas made a TV film called The Ewok Adventure. That played in the States on ABC and was a TV movie. But overseas, it was released theatrically. Overseas, you went to the movie theaters and saw The Ewok Adventure. And so for those audiences, their fourth Star Wars film is The Ewok Adventure.
Brilliant. I had good friends at school who went to see it. I remember it being in the cinemas. I didn't go myself. And I remember they were twins, actually. And I can't remember how old, but we've been about 8, I think, at the time. And they brought a letter into school saying that they had been cast in the next Ewok film. Everyone fell for it. Their sister had typed it on a typewriter, so it looked vaguely official. But I must admit, I didn't fall for it. I was like, this is rubbish. Something ridiculous. That's how obsessed young people were with Ewoks at the time.
Oh, don't knock
them. So good.
If anyone was a bit confused, that's your latest book, isn't it, Mark? About movies go forth.
While we're on it for a moment.
Yeah.
This book is called Movies Go Forth, Fourth Films and Fantastic Franchises. And that book is about the fourth films in movie series, in those popular series. So fourth Batman, Superman, Jaws, Highlander, Terminator, Halloween, Friday the 13th. And a lot more than I'm able to sort of rattle off the top of my head. And then each film in each franchise tells you something different about franchise filmmaking. And it's just not all me blathering on. It's interviews with the filmmakers of those films. So I interviewed Joel Schumacher about Batman 4 as well as 3, because I figured I'd talk to him. So it's really interviews with filmmakers, the writers and directors of those films about what they were thinking when they were making it, as well as some unmade fourth films like the fourth Sam Raimi Spider-Man film, which they were in pre-production on and it got stopped. So I found out what the story would have been for Tobey Maguire's fourth and final film.
Wow.
Because I've read the book, as you know, Mark, and I loved it. So well done. I'll just mention a couple of things that were real highlights for me. One is the artwork. I mean, there's some fantastic drawings throughout by a guy called, is it Pat Carbajal? Is that how you say it?
No, this is Robert Ball, B-A-L-L.
Oh, okay. Yeah, some great illustrations.
And then Pat did the illustrations inside.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, yeah, those illustrations. I think they're fantastic right the way through. But what I found really interesting was with four films, we always read interviews with the great directors reflecting back on great films. Mm. And we see interviews with directors of average films when they're out now, and they're never going to be honest that film's average. But what you do here with this book is you do get some really good fourth films. The Star Trek fourth is probably the most accessible Star Trek film. And Thunderball is obviously regarded as one of the best James Bond films. But you've also got a load of films that are seen as really quite average. Superman 4. You've got some that are seen as terrible. Jaws 4. So you're reflecting on, and obviously the Batman's a great example, and the Joel Schumacher interview I can't recommend highly enough. He's so honest about his mistakes and his failings and where it went wrong. That's what's interesting is we all know how a great film gets made because we read the interviews about those. But how does a very average film come to exist as a very average film? You know, like, why? Why didn't you make a great film? You know? You get that from the book. And I will just finish by saying as well, the Thunderball section is great, by the way, as we're talking Bond. But the bit I almost skipped at the end, and I'm so pleased I didn't, was there was a piece, and I've told you about this, Mark, on a film called Meatballs 4. Now, I wasn't familiar with the Meatballs series. I think it was a kind of, from the way you describe it, Mark, a bit like an American Pie kind of teen, you know, sex romp comedy thing. But anyway, because I'd never heard of it or seen it, I thought I won't bother reading that. And then I did read it. And my goodness, that is the highlight of the book. I'll give anything away. But the fact that that film got finished, got made, is a complete beginning, middle and end. The interview with the director and the writer, honestly, I'll read that again every few months, I think, because I just found it absolutely hilarious.
Welcome to Lakeside, where some of the hottest skiers have just landed a new hero.
I want you to meet our new recreation director, Ricky Wade.
He's got charm.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Victor. Oh.
He's a natural-born leader.
Come on, guys, let's do it. Come on, anything's possible if you want it bad enough. Look at Michael Jackson.
And he's got 2 weeks to turn these ski rats into superstars. It's a playground of fun and fantasy. Where the scenery is breathtaking. The passion is pulsating.
Why didn't you leave me, Ricky?
Because I was afraid, Cal.
And the romance is hot.
I think I'm going to change that 10 to a 12.
Yeah.
But the competition wants to crash this party.
Are you going to put up or shut up?
And they'll stop at nothing to get what they want.
If you don't mind.
All right, these girls are going to look like smurfs.
Now,
Kelly,
it's a race for survival.
Give me my skis.
Yeah! Meatballs 4, to the rescue.
You're very, very kind. I really appreciate you saying that. I really appreciate the support that you've given me. You've really been lovely. Steve is referring to Meatballs 4, which that's one of those films that I didn't know that Meatballs had made 4 films in it. I would have guessed maybe 2. I had no idea 3, let alone 4. I won't go too far into it, but that's Meatballs 4 started out as a independent film called Happy Campers, starring Corey Feldman, from Lost Boys.
Yeah.
And partway through production, they said, this is now Meatballs 4. So the interview is about what happens when you start a movie that's an independent film, and then partway through, they're like, no, it's Meatballs 4.
And also, when one of your lead actors has to be written out of the film overnight, and then a few days later has to be written back into the film and shot all the scenes. It's honestly, it's absolutely phenomenal and so funny to read it. So well done. And really interesting idea to do movies go fourth, fourth movies.
Yeah. Mm.
But yeah, great. Well done.
I don't know what I was thinking. I feel like it's sort of not a good idea for a book because it's kind of weird. But these fourth films, like Superman, like when people write articles on franchises that go off the rails, they routinely, maybe unfairly, will write about Batman 4, Jaws 4, and Superman 4. And I think I kind of backed into this concept based on my interest in those films, because Superman 4 was a sincere effort to return to what was great about the first two films. That the studio first went out to Richard Donner and Tom Mankiewicz and asked them to come back. They weren't ready to, but they got Christopher Reeve involved in the story, and he came up with an idea for the premise. They got Gene Hackman back, and they really tried to go back to the basics. They tried to go back to the heart and romance of Superman 4. And the same thing about Jaws 4, Jaws the Revenge. When people say this time it's personal, it's a shorthand for bad movie. People are just using that slogan to knock whatever that other movie is. This time it's personal. But it's not that these are great movies, but that the people who were making them at the time really tried to make a great movie. They tried to make the best version possible of one shark getting revenge on the family who killed a completely different shark. That's a strange premise. But once you have this idea, Jaws the Revenge, that's what you get. That's the almost logical version of what is Jaws the Revenge, even though it's not logical.
One of the things I was excited to mention when I got the chance to talk to you tonight was something that really scarred me massively for life, which was Sean at the start getting his arm bit off in that unbelievable set piece in the harbour. I was like, damn it, is a set piece that I think is so streets ahead of the rest of the movie. You know what I mean? It's unbelievable, that opener. And I also think the acting is incredible. You know, when he's like, he's looking down for his arm and he's like, there's nothing there. When he finds it, like, oh my God, this is horrendous. And I remember watching that way too young and being way too scarred for a long time about that. So you can get these nuggets of massive gold in these movies.
Yeah, I mean, these are made by, you know, made by filmmakers that are, you know, Superman, Jaws, and Planet of the Apes were directed by, let me see if I get this right, Joseph Sargent, Sidney J. Fury, and J. Lee Thompson, who are these classic old filmmakers who aren't necessarily given the same opportunities that they once were, but still are in the game and are still, you know, and are still trying to make a living and make movies that they hope entertain other people.
I love that. I think that would be like probably a fantasy role, I think, of mine. If obviously doing anything involved with movies would be absolutely unbelievable. But then, like, yeah, we need someone to direct Jaws 8. Where do I, who do I ask? Who do I, you know, that kind of thing.
This is a tale of the supernatural.
The Tapes, a podcast of the uncanny.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Join me, host Christopher Goldie, and guests as we discuss the best in unsettling television and film.
Who is this? Who is coming?
Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Search for at The Tapes Pod, part of the Pod Dojo Network.
A lot of people think Thunderball is a great Bond film. So why do you think the makers got Thunderball right? Do you think it's because there was such a continuity of obviously the leading man, but also a lot of the writers still basing them to an extent on the Fleming books? There was a lot, and obviously Broccoli still overseeing the whole thing. Do you think that helped? I mean, because it did feel Bond was building and building at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of it was the continuity of filmmakers, you know, although Guy Hamilton did Goldfinger, but a lot, as you're saying, of the key creatives were there
and
shepherding it, and particularly Broccoli and Saltzman and you know, the writers, the, you know, music. You know, there were so many of the key elements who, in Dr. No, they were sort of finding. In the first film, they were sort of finding out what are we doing, and in the second one, they were building it, and the third one, they kind of found their formula.
Yeah.
I think part of the success of the fourth film, Thunderball, was based on the goodwill of Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And then by the time they did Thunderball, there's an interview with the heroine, the Bond woman, in that. And she talks about how relaxed the set was, where they just felt like, we've got this. And they were, I mean, they worked hard and they were focused, but there was an attitude of comfort.
200.
200 livres banco.
Banco.
Banco, sir.
Carte. Eight.
Someone has to lose.
Yes, I thought I saw a specter at your shoulder.
What do you mean?
the specter of defeat, that your luck was due to change.
We'll soon find out. Any objection to raise the limit? £500, shall we say?
Too big for me.
Count me out, too. Perhaps you'd like to take the shoe. My friend won't mind. Mr.
Bond.
Oh, yes, Mr. Bond. One of my associates spoke about you.
Nothing bad, I hope.
Un banco de 500 livres.
Ah, it's your specter against mine, huh?
Le banco est fait.
You wish to put the evil eye on me, huh? We have a way to deal with that where I come from.
Well, you may hex me. Let's see what it does for the cards.
No.
No.
Seven.
Sept à la pointe.
Six. Suivi.
Banco suivi.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Eight.
Nine.
Neuf à la pompe.
You seem to be unbeatable, Mr. Bond.
No, for the moment, this sort of thing can't last.
Emilio, you promised to buy me a drink.
Soon, my dear. I want to get my money back first.
May I be allowed to buy the lady a drink?
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Then I must pass the shoe.
La même passe.
Banco.
It's going to be impossible if his luck doesn't change.
Somehow I don't think it will tonight.
You know what's interesting, though, as you're talking, asking this question, Steve, Batman 4, Batman and Robin, was made by the same creative team as Batman 3, Batman Forever. Mm. That had the same director, writer, not cast, but, you know, cinematographer, composer, and other key elements. And that was a case where even though the same creative team came back together to make another film, Batman 3 worked for most people and Batman 4 did not.
Hi there.
And you are?
Poison. Poison Ivy. Why not send Junior home early? I've got some wild oats to sow. On the other hand, youth does have its advantages. Endurance, stamina. Forget the geriatric bat. Come, join me. My garden needs tending. I'll take it from here, pal.
Wouldn't you like the earrings, too?
Some lucky boy's about to hit the honeypot. I'll include an evening of my company for the winner. I'll bring everything you see here, plus everything you don't.
I bet $50,000 for Poison Ivy. $100,000.
$1 million.
$2 million.
You don't have it. $3 million.
I'll borrow it from you. $4 million.
$5 million.
That's a utility belt, not a money belt. $6 million.
$7 million. Never leave the cave without it.
You two boys aren't gonna start fighting over little old me now, are you?
I think with the Batman, I've always felt with the Joel Schumacher Batman, the first one, Batman Forever, it felt like it was right on the edge.
being terrible, but it was on the good side. It stayed on the good side. So it didn't actually have to move very far in the sequel to fall over and become, you know, pretty terrible. Do you know what I mean? In some ways, they're very similar films, but one is on one side of the line and the other is on the good side. You know, the entertaining, you can buy the craziness of it. The other one, the craziness just goes that bit too far. That's how I see those Batman films.
Yeah, and one of the challenging things about making these is that the creatives are not totally on their own. They are reporting to their bosses, who are the studios who are paying for all this, and they're working with those parameters. A lot of times on these films, particularly superhero films, they are given instructions on which villains or how many villains. And the purpose of having multiple villains is that if Batman is fighting Poison Ivy, Mr. Freeze, and Bane, and there's Robin and Batgirl, and then there's Batman, those are what, six action figures? Six cups at McDonald's. They're told to make sure you have a newly designed Batsuit because you need to sell a different action figure. And it's really the merchandise that pays for the movies. That's where the profit is for the studios. So they hope to make their money back and break even and plus some on box office. But that's not the thing that drives these things all the time. A lot of the times it's the merchandising.
I can only back that up. I mean, Batman and Robin was like the first Batman film that I remembered when I was growing up. And I remember to the point of that, like, so cereal boxes used to have toys that you could collect of the Batman and Robin figures. It was everywhere, but they were always, it was a marketing tool. It was in terms of like, we'll give you a snippet of this, so then you'll go and buy the real thing from the toy store. And I bought everything that Christmas of Batman and Robin. And you're right, you know, you can retrospectively or say it's a terrible film, and in a lot of ways, yeah, it is. But it did set out what it was supposed to do in terms of selling the toys.
Yeah, sometimes a filmmaker will have enough power to impose their art on these commercial projects. You know, you see that with the Christopher Nolan trilogy. It's not, there's no four times the charm for Christopher Nolan. He told the three films that he wanted to tell, and then he stopped. Steve was talking about Star Trek, and he said that Star Trek 4 was the most accessible. And he's absolutely right. You know, with the Star Trek films, they're not really built to compete in the Star Wars universe.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars are meant to appeal to a mass audience. Star Trek, in its DNA on the TV show, were people sitting around talking about philosophical problems. Mm. And then the first Star Trek film, the motion picture, was a natural extension of that. And then, by the time the second one is really the one that established the template for the movie, which is let's have the crew go up against a strong evil figure, Khan. But the fourth one was really the time where they opened it up to the non-Trekkers and said that you'll be able to enjoy this film without having a knowledge of the TV series or the previous films.
Mm.
But you just need to understand, it's a character film. It's a fish out of water comedy.
Star Trek 4, The One with the Whales.
Excuse me. Would you mind stopping that noise? You.
The sins of all our fathers picked up on us the sun. The only choice we're given is how many megatons.
Excuse me.
And
would you mind stopping that damn noise?
And I say screw you.
Admiral, may I ask you a question?
Spock, don't call me Admiral. You used to call me Jim. Don't you remember Jim? What's your question?
Your use of language has altered since our arrival. It is currently laced with, shall I say, more colorful metaphors. Double dumbass on you, and so forth.
You mean the profanity?
Yes.
That's simply the way they talk here.
Nobody pays any attention to you unless you swear every other word. You'll find it in all the literature of the period.
For example?
Well, the collected works of Jacqueline Suzanne. The novels are Harold Robbins.
Ah, the giants.
I was saying with casual Star Trek view, I don't think Star Trek has the following in this country like it does in the United States. Probably because it's full of too much hope and positivity. And we're not that hopeful or positive, certainly about our own countrymen. But Star Trek IV, it is really, it's a comedy. And I watched them all. I got the Blu-rays for Christmas, all the original films. So I watched them all recently in a row. And I have to say, Star Trek IV, I recommend it to anyone because it's just a very funny film. It's just done just right. It's got drama and it's got excitement and action, but it's just, you don't need to like Star Trek. It's just guys from the future landing in, well, what was present day America and trying to fit in, but which they do very badly. And it's a good fun romp. Yeah.
You know, I spoke to one of the co-writers for that, and his sort of challenge, he said, was you have these two leads, Spock and Kirk, or Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. You need to give both characters something to do. He called it, you have to give both of them the opportunity to drive the bus. That means you have to give both of them equal opportunity to figure something out, punch out a guy, or, you know, come up with an idea that gets them to the next thing. That has to be a co-lead. And that's an example, you know, when we talk about the action figures dictating the parameters of the movie, here you have actors and their needs and their goals for the film dictating the structure of that film.
It's quite rare, isn't it, these days to have two protagonists in a film as well. You know, I think we've spoken about the odd Bond film, such as Octopussy, where Stephen Burkoff's character Orlov is effectively a protagonist at one point. Natalia in GoldenEye is a protagonist. And it doesn't happen as much now, I think, because modern cinema tastes are you back a superhero, you back a franchise lead, and we really don't have time for the other people. We'll have time for a baddie, but we don't need him until the second act, at least. And we want to focus more on characters. And I think you'll have seen that change over the years in a lot of these films. But it's interesting that sometimes if you finished a trilogy, or what could have been a trilogy, the fourth one, as you said in your book, it's a chance to do something a little bit different. And certainly the case of Star Trek, but some of these other films that are in your book, I don't know. I mean, I remember you talking about Scream as well, Scream 4, which is sort of was a trilogy, wasn't it? And then they did get the original team back, like Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven. Sometimes I suppose it's about money as well, isn't it? Like, this is a beloved franchise.
Yeah.
They're all up for it. We've got the same cast. Might as well do it again.
Yeah, Scream 4 is an example of...
I like it.
of them trying to start another trilogy with legacy cast.
Yes, yeah.
As well as new characters, but not getting the box office returns sufficient to start 4, 5, 6 all as one plot. So when they return for 5... You know, each time after that took a little, was almost a restart.
That's like the new trilogy now, isn't it? I think 5, I presume there'll be a
5, 6 and...
Yeah, yeah. I prefer 4 personally, but anyway. Tell us a bit about the Spider-Man one. So why did that not get made?
So Spider-Man is one of those cases where Spider-Man 3 was so popular. Spider-Man 3...
Yeah.
Made more money than Spider-Man 1 and 2, even though it's not as well regarded as either film today. But it was sufficiently popular to let's have the same team come back together and make a fourth and final Spider-Man film. There's more of that story to tell. His Peter Parker and their story has not been resolved. There's also a legitimate storytelling reason
to
do the fourth one. But by the time you get to a fourth one, it's expensive. It's expensive to pay the director and the stars. It becomes really top heavy. And they were but they were still willing to do it, but they were pushing Sam Raimi in a direction creatively where he didn't want to go. he, for the third one, didn't really want to use the symbiote character. And he felt like that, you know, that's an example of the studio saying, use this villain.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want to. He did it out of a sense of responsibility or duty to the fans. But he, from that film, he said, I'm not going to make another film that I'm not personally invested in. And so he wanted to stick to his creative guns, and they were moving him in a direction, and it sort of just sort of fell up. And he wanted to tell his story in such a way that would have definitively put an end to Peter Parker's story. And he said, let me do my thing. I know my ideas for this film are a little unconventional, and my ideas for Spider-Man 4 don't lead to Spider-Man 5. However, you're going to reboot it anyway. Let me end this story definitively, and then you go make Spider-Man 1 again with somebody else. And they didn't have a meeting of the minds, and even though they were in prep and had started casting, it fell apart.
It's a shame, isn't it? Yeah. I do think there's more story to tell with that one particularly. I know what you mean, though, because then Tobey Maguire, Sam Raimi, they all know, well, you're going to have me to continue the story. So the costs are ramped up, aren't they? There's some other ones which you've focused on, and these are sort of, we've touched on a bit, legacy sequels, such as Rambo. Now, that, again, was probably before the current wave of all these legacy sequels. But that was a good long gap, wasn't there, between the original three?
With Rambo, that was intended to end the series. Nothing happens to him in such a way where he doesn't get killed off. But it was written to be his final adventure, and it was and in the last scene, you see him returning home, and that was important for that character whose identity was wrapped up in America and America discarded as a Vietnam veteran, to not welcome him back, but at least have the character who was out of the country for 2, 3, and most of 4 to come back home and, return to America, his home country.
Why'd you come back?
Waiting for you.
I told you before I can't help you.
Why?
Don't want to. Where are your friends?
At the hotel. I can take care of myself.
Is that so?
Yes. I know you don't like us.
I never said that.
Well, it looks that way. We need to go and help these people.
Who you help? Them or you?
Does it matter?
Yeah, it matters.
Them. There's nothing missing in our lives back home. We're here to make a difference. We believe all lives are special.
Some live, some no.
Really? If everyone thought like you, nothing would ever change.
Nothing does change.
Of course it does. Nothing stays the same.
Live your life because you got a good one.
It's what I'm trying to do.
No, what you're trying to do is change what is.
And what is?
That we're like animals. It's in the blood. It's natural. Peace, that's an accident. It's what is. When you're pushed, killing's as easy as breathing. And the killing stops in one place or starts in another, but that's okay, because you're killing for your country. But it ain't your country who's asking. It's a few men up top who want it. Old men start it. Young men fight it. Nobody wins. Everybody in the middle dies. And nobody tells the truth. God's gonna make all that go away?
But it was sufficiently profitable that they made a fifth one, even though they weren't necessarily intending to.
Yeah.
And the thing about Stallone, while we're on Stallone, Rocky IV is the most popular Rocky movie. And it's also the one that's tonally different from the other ones.
Yeah.
Over the top. It's got a lot of music in it. It's got like 5 montages. There's like 20 minutes of montages of clips from other parts of the movie or from other parts of the series. And then during the pandemic, Stallone went back and re-edited the movie. and got rid of everything that was a little bit goofy. They got rid of the Rocky robot that
he
used to fall in love with. And he recut it and re-released it, which I think is kind of interesting. And then for the Creed, those Creed movies are actually not... Then after Rocky IV, there was, you know, 5 and 6. But those Creed movies are actually sequels to the events of Rocky IV.
Yeah.
I only knew about the re-edit, and I quite like the Rocky films. I only knew about the re-edit reading your book. I hadn't realized that it happened. I hadn't seen a wide release of it here unless I just missed it. But, yeah, I'm quite interested to see the re-edit. But I've got a soft spot for the original Rocky IV. I don't care.
Great.
Yeah, it's not... It's probably... He probably made a more mature film. But I don't think people are going to, I don't think it's going to replace the original cut of Rocky IV, nor should it. It makes it a more serious film in keeping with the rest of the series. But so much of these sort of the over the top nature of it, which is enjoyable in Rocky IV, is absent. So I think a lot of fans are going to watch it and think, oh, interesting. I prefer the original.
My God!
Creed is down! Apollo is down, and he could be badly hurt!
Let's
get you guys out of here!
The winner, Ivan Drago!
Apollo!
I cannot be defeated.
Is he okay?
Somebody get him back over there!
There is no movement by Creed.
To the right elbow!
I defeat all that.
Is he dead? Get out of here!
It's absolute pandemonium!
You can do it, son. And you feel the real champion.
Where's the stretcher?
Somebody sent Carson
Dan.
What started out as a joke has turned out to be a disaster.
Creed appears to be in very serious condition.
The men are dying.
You can make fun. If he dies, he dies.
It's a funny one, Rocky IV, because if you were, I suppose, there growing up with him at the time, first one's a real rags to riches underdog, pretty low key, gritty, and quite dark places. And if you've seen him gradually his career, you know, you see the different him rise to power, struggles with holding on to that fame and celebrity in the second and third. And then the fourth one, you know, was not as well received, was it? Because it was more popcorn entertainment. And then what happens, of course, is that kids and the first time I watched a Rocky film was the fourth one because it was the most accessible. And I think non-diehard, non-boxing fans, that's the one I'd say, watch that one first.
Well, you know what's interesting is I think that's the only Rocky film that it's sort of about the fight. The fight was always a metaphor for something else. Rocky IV is just like America versus the Soviet Union. Like that film was all centered around the fight.
Revenge as well for Creed.
But that's what happens is... When you make these sequel films, it sometimes inadvertently changes the nature of the hero. So, like, if you look at Die Hard, it's not a cop movie. It's a film about a guy, an ordinary man in an extraordinary circumstance.
Yes.
The fact that he's a cop gives him the skills to fight the bad guys, but he's just an ordinary guy. But by the time when that keeps on happening to him again and again, he's no longer an ordinary guy. And then by the time you do Die Hard 4, he's jumping from, I can't remember, like a helicopter to an airplane, then falling off and not really getting injured. You change, you go so far away from the guy who stepped on little shards of glass to this Superman.
That
it changes the nature. And the Bruce Willis and the writer had a different idea for Die Hard 4, where they wanted to call it Die Effin' Hard, but they didn't say effin'. And in it, Bruce Willis's character, John McClane, would have gotten his hand stuck under a downed helicopter, and Bruce Willis would have had to take a knife and cut his hand free. And then had a, you know, did the rest of the movie without his, you know, gun.
Amazing.
And so this the screenwriter told me this whole wonderful alternate story that was very much rated R and very different from the PG-13 film.
Yeah.
That
wow.
Do you have a particular fourth of anything anywhere that you really would go to bat for?
No, you know, I try not to put my opinions of these films in there. I might like Superman 4 and have a greater fondness for it than other people. But I try not to. I feel like whether I like a book, a movie or not is not the point of the exercise. That not all the movies that I include in Movies Go Forth are great, necessarily great works of art. They're not. Some of them are not anybody's favorite film, possibly, probably. I don't know how many Porky's 4 fans there are. But it doesn't mean, but all of those films were made by people who love making movies and who tried the hardest they could with the circumstances that were in front of them to make the best film that they could. And even when the final effort doesn't live up to their own expectations, the effort was worth it, and their experience was worth it, and the stories that they have to tell about it are priceless.
That's such a fabulous answer in the context of your work. So you mentioned there that, like, perhaps, you know, like, as a writer and as the author of these books, you don't want to perhaps pick one. What about Mark Edlitz, the movie lover? Just the dude who goes to the movies. Like, what is there a particular...
No, I mean, I love all these franchises. I mean, I do. I love Superman and Batman and Die Hard and James Bond and Star Wars and Terminator and Highlander. I love Planet of the Apes.
Oh,
no, I love Psycho. I mean, I'm a movie lover first. And so this was my opportunity to write about things that I personally love a lot.
Your love of movies really does shine. It really, really comes across.
I think we'd have to go on to the Crystal Skull. And our sister podcast, For Your Reconsideration, has just looked at this film. It's sort of one where the original trilogy, not that it was meant to be a trilogy, but it was all done in the 80s, wasn't it? It was all Spielberg and Lucas, Harrison Ford, all wrapped up, going off into the distance with the horses at the end of Last Crusade. And then, hang on, all the main people involved want to do it again. The worry with that was you can't get anywhere near as good as any of those three, so why make it? So it's already got that pressure behind it.
This ain't going to be easy. Not as easy as it used to be. Was closer.
You're a teacher?
Part time.
Yeah, you know, James Mangold, as we're recording this Indie 5 we just released, and Mangold was talking about the challenges that he faced in 5 and that Spielberg faced in 4. And he said something which I thought was interesting, and I'll repeat right now. He said that the form and content of the first three were the same. That the first three films were about good versus evil in black and white terms, and that the style of those films were classic Hollywood style when those stories were told. So there was a merger of content and form, classic Hollywood style, good versus evil. He said that by the time you get to 4, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, you're now getting into a different era of moving from the you know, the 40s and 50s or whatever to the 60s. And now to the 50s and 60s where, things are more where morality is more murky, and that things are more no longer black and white, and so that the style, the form, and the content are no longer the same. And that was, he said, the challenge for 5 and 4.
Yeah,
I got some of the dates wrong, but you.
Yeah.
I feel like you got the gist of what makes I was trying sense. To say, even if I was
set, you know, certainly. When you've got the Nazis as the baddies, it's black and white, isn't it? That's everyone's routine. They know that they're the baddies throughout. But then, the fourth one is a bit different because it's more of a mystery and you go on this journey with them and you don't really know what it's going to be about. Last Crusade, the Ark, you know what it's about before it's even, you know, barely started. You know what they've got to find. You know what they've got to do. You know who they've got to stop.
But they always reveal the thing's powers are always different than you would expect.
Correct. Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And if I don't know. I'll defend it to a certain extent, certainly the fourth one. But again, it made a ton of money, didn't it? So
for me, it felt a bit like when I saw Crystal Skull, it felt a bit like how I felt watching Die Another Day, which you could argue was a sort of fourth Bond film because
then
Goldeneye came in 95 and it's the fourth one of Brosnan's films. It's sort of a fourth film in that way. But they both feel very similar to me. They've got bad CGI in both, lots of it. but also the characters aren't allowed to develop in the way they were in the previous films. Not like characterization in the previous films was always handled, I think, quite subtly and lightly. It wasn't rammed down your throat like some current films try to do. But it was done very nicely like that, whereas neither Die Another Day or Crystal Skull seemed to manage to do that at all. It felt forced when it was characterization and very clunky, horrible dialogue. And I think they're both guilty. You know, I actually thought they came out at a similar time. I looked and Crystal Skull was quite a few years later, wasn't it? Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting.
Of course, he was older, wasn't he, Harrison Ford? And the character had to be older. So I think maybe gave him too much of a passive role in the film. And he couldn't quite be the indie doing the things that no one else could do. In the same way that Bond, you know, we haven't had an old man Bond film yet. And I know a few fans are well up for that. But they always say Pierce is the one who should do it, which would be quite interesting.
Connery tried it with Never
Say Never Again.
Where commented a little bit on, you know, his age and a little bit, I'm too old for this stuff, you know. Not those words, of course. Mm. And I thought that was, I'm a big Never Say Never Again fan.
Yeah, yeah.
Too many free radicals, that's your problem.
Free radicals, sir?
Yeah, they're toxins that destroy the body and the brain, caused by eating too much red meat and white bread and too many dry martinis.
Then I shall cut out the white bread, sir.
You'll do more than that, 007. From now on, you will be suffering a strict regimen of diet and exercise. We shall purge those toxins from you.
Shrublands?
You got it.
You could argue Skyfall kind of goes down that line. There's a lot of things about how, you know, is he still up for this? Is he still physically fit? Is he able? That's the nearest we've got to, really.
No, I think that's a fair point. You know, we sort of missed Bond's middle years.
Yeah.
One and two were Bond, where James Bond begins-ish.
Mm.
And then fourth, he's, as you're saying, a little too old for this. You know, he's recovering from physical injuries.
Yeah.
He's burnt out. He's played out. He's finished. But we never got the Daniel Craig Bond at sort of the top of his powers.
Yeah, I agree.
You go from Daniel Craig being a blunt instrument who's not yet effectively qualified to be a 00. And bearing in mind Quantum and Casino are effectively one adventure.
Yeah.
It's his next adventure. He's now too old.
Yeah.
He goes from being too young to too old with nothing in between.
And it's a shame because there's a video game that came out in between, Bloodstone, that would have been perfect to just placed in there as a film in between, and we've got a bit more of a consistent storyline.
Yeah, that was written by Bruce Fiersten, who wrote some of the Pierce Brosnan
things. Yeah. The good writer from the Pierce Brosnan years.
Yeah, he wrote Goldeneye, didn't he, I think?
Yeah. Yeah,
some of Goldeneye and pretty much all of Tomorrow Never Dies, I think.
Yeah. Not Dying of the Day, Steve.
And Bruce also wrote part of the, I guess, I can't remember which book this is from. This might be from The Lost Adventures of James Bond. I can't remember. There was a ride you went on at a theme park where you first, it's a James Bond theme park ride. And it starts with Judi Dench's M and Desmond Llewellyn's Q.
Yeah.
Talking to you and talking you through the thing. And then the theme park attraction is you're watching a first person film where you, the audience member, are watching the adventures entirely through Bond's point of view. So it's a short point of view movie. And he wrote the Desmond Llewellyn stuff and the Judi Dench stuff.
I think that might have been License to Thrill because of the Trocadero in London, and I never went, missed it. I mean, how good would that be? I suppose maybe Bruce Feirstein, that his video game, because people say Tomorrow Never Dies is the most video game sort of Bond, isn't it? It's quite shooting at times, which is interesting. Yeah.
I interviewed him for one of these books about it, and he said that for the video game, he was trying to write sort of a James Bond adventure that you wouldn't necessarily see on the screen, but that he would have gone on. So it wouldn't have been like the big adventure between the big movie adventures. I think it succeeds. I'm a fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. And I think it actually, what you just said, the aim was, that's exactly what that film is.
Oh, and he also wrote some of James Bond Legends, which imagines Craig's Bond in each different Bond era, which I thought was fun. I thought it was a fun idea to see how Daniel Craig would function in different eras. Yeah. I know that fans don't, it's not universally embraced, but because of the gameplay mostly, I think.
I'd love to see Daniel Craig dropped into Octopussy.
Yeah. As a clown. Yeah.
I don't know. I think my thing is if you're going to play License to Kill, I want to see Timothy Dalton in License to Kill. I don't want to play as Daniel Craig. I'm sorry, you know. But
I don't think that there are games that where, you know, people thought, wouldn't it be great if multiple Bonds, if we get... There's often licensing issues where if you're using the likeness of multiple actors, whether it's Bond or something else, you have to pay for that privilege. And then these games become prohibitively expensive.
Mm.
So that's one of the challenges of doing a game like that, which would be fabulous, but that's one of the challenges. But, you know, the Sean Connery...
Exactly.
From Rush with Love.
Yeah, that was his last Bond performance.
I mean, that is unbelievable. It's so random.
It is.
It's so good, honestly, that, like, just mid-noughties Sean Connery. I'll come and do For Rush with Love, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Bruce wrote that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, we'd have each of the Bond films done as video games with the actors' likenesses for each one. And they could just release them every few years, you know, they don't need to be in any rush. They could have been releasing them these last few years, but anyway. just to go back to Thunderball, of course. So that was the fourth James Bond film. You have an interview with Luciana Paluzzi, and we spoke to her, and I mean, she's wonderful, wonderful lady to start with.
Yeah.
But you did, and you also mentioned this on the set atmosphere where Terence Young would make sure everyone was looked after. You know, there were boat parties, the catering on the beach. And I think they even sort of watched each other's scenes as they were in the Bahamas. It was it sounds like a one in a million experience for everyone involved. And I think that only came with the three that had gone before. Terence Young was back, obviously. So the dream team were there, weren't they, really?
Yeah, there was just a confidence in what they were doing, which seemed to have helped the making of the movie. And it's, you know, when you say what Bond film was seen by more than others, it's a little bit hard just because the accounting was not as rigorous and as then as it was now. But it's generally believed that Thunderball sold more tickets than any other Bond film up until recently.
Yeah.
It's possible that Skyfall sold more tickets. I'm not talking about just bottoms and seats. It could be that Skyfall sold more, but you're still comparing that to, you know, a movie from the 60s.
Yeah.
And so for many, many years, Thunderball was the one to be.
And of course, at the time as well, you know, you couldn't watch James Bond if you were living in most of the lots of countries in the world, could you? You know, it's been opened up, the cinematic world. I know certainly China at the time would not have been seeing Thunderball, whereas Skyfall, of course, some of it was set in China. So that's changed in those years. But Thunderball, we've just recently done a huge review of it. And it's one of those which, because it's so iconic, because it has all the ingredients of Bond films, all the cliches have become, you know, based on things from that film, you know, a villain with an eye patch, a villain's desk where one of them gets killed. And it became the one Mike Myers found easiest to sort of take the mick out of in Austin Powers. I'd like a fourth one of them, by the way, but that's another
Just as a thing, there was rumors of a pre-production fourth Austin Powers film, and it was called For Your Thighs Only.
I love the fact as if Mike Myers was like, I need to make the perfect trilogy, and I won't touch it again after that.
Mark, if you need a new idea for a new book, The Lost Adventures of Austin Powers.
Over time, of course, when you speak to people like my dad and that generation, they still regard it as one of the very top. You know, the first five are really regarded as peak Bond in terms of that. But over time, because people seem to think they latch on to, say, the underwater scenes look slow, things like that, they latch on to, doesn't Sean look bored, which is, I think, is complete rubbish. And, you know, they say that about You Only Live Twice as well. Because of the history, maybe, as well, with the remake of Never Say Never Again, maybe that's hurt it a little bit. What tends to happen is, when something's so popular, if you're a fan of it, you're like, well, I know that one's popular. I want to sort of go for the underdog. And then almost Goldfinger is in danger of being slightly overlooked these days because everyone knows it's a classic, everyone loves it, but that means people aren't really talking about it as much. And I hope that certainly for young Bond fans, people come into the franchise more recently, I do hope they give Thunderball a chance because really seeing it at the cinema for us when they showed them on the last year in the... I'm sorry they didn't mark in America, but yeah, the UK were very lucky in that sense. So we had one a week. And Thunderball was a different film on the big screen. The sound editing, I think John was saying, it was just an amazing cinematic experience. And that's because they knew exactly what they were doing at that time, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been talking about fours for most franchises, but for Bond, it's the third time, which is often the charm. You know, Connery's third Goldfinger, Moore's third Spy Who Loved Me are really sort of what are often considered their key films. Sadly, with Timothy Dalton, we never got a third. And I had always been, this is my clever transition to the Lost Adventures.
You did it very well, Bond,
based on synergy. My suggestion.
I hope there's something that you can take from the knowledge that it's on my coffee table right now. Like, it is. I think it's beautiful. Like, seriously, our WhatsApp group, when we saw this book on Amazon, it blew up. The WhatsApp group was like, have you guys seen this? You know,
great.
Like, we have to own this. When my family did the whole, you know, like WhatsApp Christmas list group, that was the only thing I put in it.
I should add that the cover of The Lost Adventures of James Bond was Sean Longmore, who two covers, and I love them both so much. I was like, well, what if we do both? That was all Sean, who's a genius artist, and I'm grateful that I get to occasionally work with him.
Man, that is awesome.
Hi, this is Andrei Sushnevsky, and you're listening to Really 007.
We never got a third. We got his first one was very much in keeping with the previous Bonds. The same tone, the same tenor, the same style. The second one was much grittier, much more down to earth, much more violent. And so the third one, everyone wanted to know, what would that have been like for Dalton? Would it have been more like the first one, less like the second one? Would it be the best of both worlds? And it's important to remember that Dalton's third one was going to get made. You know, there's sometimes a thought that it didn't get made because the second one didn't do as well. And it's true. To be clear, the second one did not do as well. It did not do what they expected. It was a financial disappointment. But that was not the end of Dalton as Bond at that time. They were moving forward with ideas for a third and even a fourth Dalton. Mm. But there was studio politics and lawsuits unrelated to Bond that Bond sort of got swept away with or in that put it on hold. And by the time the studio got that all cleared out, Dalton was out. But they were going to tell a third James Bond story with Timothy Dalton. And the book goes into two different versions of that story, which I almost think of as two separate movies. To me, they don't feel like a rewrite of each other. It feels like two separate films. The first was written by Michael G. Wilson and Alphonse Ruggiero, who was an American television writer who did Miami Vice and another show called Wise Guys. Because of the Miami Vice connection, people thought that was going to be a drug-related movie. It was not. It was going to be more of a techno thriller. Mm. One of the reasons they hired him is two of the reasons. One is the other film, the other television series was something called Wise Guy, which was sort of a precursor to Sopranos with serialized storytelling. And so it was character-based on regular TV. And then the other reason that they hired him is because he was a TV writer and could write fast. And they were trying to get it done before sort of an upcoming deadline, possibly a writer's strike. Anyway, so that's the one that people always think it's Bond versus the robots. Now, there is a moment in the third where Bond does seem to battle someone who is an android. But it's not Bond versus Terminator. It it would have been handled where... You were left wondering exactly what this character was. You would have seen that they had android-esque parts, but you wouldn't have necessarily concluded that they were a total android. You know, you know how with Live and Let Die, it ends with... He's been killed twice. You know, Baron Samedi's been killed twice. And then here he is at the end of the train. It's never explained. It's a little fun thing for the audience. And my impression is that's how they would have handled the Terminator-esque character in Timothy Dalton's third Bond, Unmade.
Because you did have, didn't you? Terminator 2 was absolutely massive, wasn't it?
Massive.
And but Bond films have always leaned traditionally on what was popular at the time, but they'll do it in their own Bond way. And I always say when people say, I mean, it's quite a niche group of people who know about this Terminator, the third Bond film for Dalton.
Yeah.
But you always think, if Dalton was in it, they're still the same producers. They're not going to... It's not just going to be some cyborg chasing Bond, you know. They will try and ground it in reality as it was his Bond.
Yeah, and it should be noted that never came to be.
No.
They didn't... It was... You know, it's like when we look at these unmade screenplays and treatments, we should think of them as the thinking of the time or... as an idea that they were exploring.
Mm.
So someone says, wouldn't it be cool if, and someone else, they talk about it a lot and they say, okay, give it a shot. And then, but they never used it. So it's important not to be too critical of the idea, I think.
The Diamonds Are Forever was going to be a direct sequel to On a Majesty. That's another lost or unmade Bond, isn't it?
I find it interesting, Mark, that you as an American has written a book about a missing Timothy Dalton film, because you're right about License to Kill didn't do the business of Daylights, but I think mostly that was in the States. I think it still made roughly the same money as Living Daylights outside of the States. So you do get an impression that Dalton hadn't quite won the American audience over.
And
do you any idea why that might be the case, whereas he seemed to be pretty popular the rest of the world?
I don't know. I loved him. I thought he was great. You know, when they announced him, I remember watching Flash Gordon again and thinking, you know, this guy is funny. He's debonair. He's great at action. I thought his Living Daylights was a classic Bond story where he
tried
to show a little more emotion and a little bit more complexity than we're used to. But I don't know. I don't feel like that the general public embraced him in the same way. And I was hoping with a third Bond would have given him a chance to cement his reputation as a well-deserved and a great Bond.
I think you're right. I think actually, bizarrely as well, not just for his reputation at the time, but historically, people coming to Bond now, if you look back and someone only did two Bonds, you could draw a conclusion from that they weren't right or whatever. Whereas if they've done three, that shows a confidence in their actor.
And we know the reasons there wasn't the third, but all of us guys here love Dog. License to Kill is my favourite Bond. It's top as well. And John, it's pretty high on your list as well.
Oh, it's my favourite film of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. So we're all huge fans of it. And we all love Daylights as well. So we find it hard to judge. I mean, I'm a little bit older than these guys. So I did see it at the cinema, License to Kill, and I just thought it was the best thing ever. But you just can't judge, you know, people's taste. It's a funny one. I think it was probably ahead of its time, going a bit darker like that so soon after Roger Moore, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people had a little bit where they weren't prepared for it. They weren't prepared for it. I think you're right. And I think because the general public thinks that he didn't make a third because of financial reasons, I think it's a slight unfortunate stain on his reputation.
Yeah.
It somehow frames him in a light which is not deserving. And then the other thing I'll just say is that at that time, the American market for Bond, it was considered more important for Bond films to do well in America than elsewhere. That was just the financial realities of filmmaking at the time, not just Bond, but with other films. This might be useful information in general. Let's say a film costs $5 to make, and then you spend $5. So you made a movie, it costs $5. It costs $5 million. And it comes out and it makes $5 million. Has your film done well? No. It's a financial failure. Why? Because your film also needed prints and advertising that was also equal to that $5 million.
Yeah.
So that's a $10 million film. So if your film costs $10 million and makes $10 million, makes $5 million, you're definitely closer to being a success. But in America, let's say 50% of that movie money goes back to the studio, and then the other 50% goes back to the theater. Now, that's not completely true. It's not exactly 50%. It could be 60% for the first weekend. But the longer it's in the theater, the greater percentage goes to the theater owner.
Mm.
And that number is less advantageous to the theater to overseas. So if your film is in America gets 50% to the studio, 50% to the theaters, more goes to the theaters overseas. So the ability to figure out how much did that film make is much more complicated to the outsiders looking in. I just think it's just useful to know.
Yeah. One of my favorite James Bond book ever, honestly, genuinely. Absolutely.
Oh, that's so sweet of you.
Absolutely love the book. One of my favorite books. The third Timothy Dalton film has kept me up at night. It's one of the things I would have adored. But I'm really glad at some of the stuff you said, because actually I've got to say, when I read it in here, I actually came out thinking, I'm glad there wasn't a third one. because I'll tell you why, right? And now you clarified some stuff, and I liked what you said about that kind of ambiguous nature of a Baron Samedi character. I like that idea. The amazing thing, why I love Dalton so much, is because he's got a 2 out of 2 record. He's not got a dud. And it's the idea that you're wanting more. You know, listen, I desperately need more. But when we talked to John Glenn a few years ago, and John Glenn made this point about how License to Kill was made specifically for Dalton. It was the fit around the character. And I just cannot get my head around Timothy Dalton fighting androids and robots. Do you know what I mean? That I couldn't get my head around that. I'd come to the point where I'd made peace that I'm glad that film wasn't made.
I hear you. I mean, for many, many years, I had this weird, I'll call it an obsession, with the third unmade Dalton film. And for me, writing the book and looking at what could have been his third and what could have been his fourth, and an alternate version of his first, it provided a measure of closure for me, a quantum of solace.
Yeah.
Very good.
Now, you see, the fourth one, I was like, oh, please make that tomorrow.
But I mean, just hearing you talk, I was thinking, oh, well, I think you would have liked the fourth one, because the fourth one felt very Fleming. It felt like a return to classic Bond. And yeah. Then the alternate first one would have been a James Bond origin story. And he would have been partnered with a senior agent who would teach him the ropes and teach him all the skills that makes him the character that we love. That's sort of the abbreviated potted history of 3, 4, and 1.
So good that.
We're getting into Star Wars territory with this.
Yeah.
3, 4, and 1 now, yeah.
Rob, you've actually got your own unmade at the moment. Lost James Bond adventure, haven't you?
Yeah. if you want to call it. Yeah, I have this sort of like, right, oh, how do you even begin with this one? So I thought, Mark, that perhaps that the only two, like, right, so if I were to ask you, of all the James Bonds and all the James Bond women, which Bond and which woman do you see them settling down with sort of like monogamously in a long-term relationship to see out the end of their days? When I thought about it like that, I only came up with one answer.
Who'd you come up with?
Dalton's Bond and Pam.
Oh, that's nice.
Under the specific circumstances that after License to Kill, they had an agreement like, hey, look, you're a CIA plane pilot. I'm like a flipping secret agent. In 30 years, if we're not doing out, you're kind of cool. Why don't we just, you know, like we'll get together kind of thing. So I've been writing this thing where they're together and they're both in their 60s in the Caribbean and Bond's got a boat rental business. I'm having a really nice time doing it.
Awesome.
And I'm not sure anyone will ever read it, but I'm really enjoying it, and it's really nice, you know. It's nice, like a wish fulfillment kind of thing.
Oh,
awesome.
Yeah,
of course Dalton was never really truly in the running for Goldeneye. I know Cubby wanted him to do it, but yeah, it was Cubby against the studios, and the studios had the money, so he was never going to win. But actually, although I prefer Dalton as a Bond to Pierce Brosnan, I think I don't think anybody could have played Bond better in Goldeneye than Pierce Brosnan did. There are scenes in that film that I genuinely think only Pierce could have done that well.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, they obviously wrote it to suit him, but so I wouldn't replace Pierce, is what I'm saying, to get a third Dalton film in Goldeneye, because Pierce was in that first Bond film absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, I think he's very good in that. I think Pierce Brosnan's always been good as an actor in the Bond films, even if sometimes the films are not always what we would want for him. But I also think that it's good that he didn't play Bond in Living Daylights. I don't think he was quite ready yet, even though at that time I wanted him to play Bond, because I was a fan of his in Remington Steele. He was originally cast and then couldn't do it. So I think we got each actor at the time they should have played.
Correct.
Pierce is a good actor, but I don't think he could have brought that intensity that Tim did to angry scenes, you know, at the fair and such like in Daylight. So you're right. I think you're absolutely the nail on the head. We got both actors at the right time.
We've talked about this kind of thing on our podcast before, because obviously on social media, you get a lot of, oh, imagine if Dalton did Goldeneye. And we kind of come to the conclusion that, no, we're glad for the actors that we got in every single one. What we'd actually want is, what if there was a Dalton third film? What if there was a Brosnan fifth film? What if in between Honor Majesty's Secret Service and Diamonds Are Forever, there was the Lazenby Revenge film? You know, those are the things that keep me excited, definitely.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen that Lazenby Revenge film. That's too bad we didn't get it. I asked Tom Mankiewicz about that in for Live and Let Die. How come Bond isn't really, in Diamonds Are Forever, I apologize.
Yeah.
How come Bond isn't really seeking revenge on Blofeld? I mean, there's a pre-title sequence where he's like, you know, where's Blofeld, and he kills him. But Tom Mankiewicz said that they didn't want to confuse Sean Connery's return in Diamonds Are Forever with George Lazenby's loss in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I was like, okay, that makes sense. I get you. I get it.
Yeah, because it's the only one that goes back, isn't it? Yeah. It's the only one that's in the whole series where you had a run of Sean, then you get a new actor, and now we're going back. And particularly after the biggest thing that ever happens to Bond in the books, it would have been a bit weird. Yeah, you're right. I haven't thought about that. It would have been a bit weird to see him still mourning when you've had such an effective mourning.
Another actor's loss.
Yeah. And the way they do it, I think, not necessarily in that one, but in the Timothy Dalton ones, in The Spy Who Loved Me, there's just a few little lines thrown in where he was married, died, like, all right, you've made it, you know. That, to me, is enough to say, this is the same character. I don't need to imagine Roger Moore at the side of the road with Tracy in his arms, but I now completely buy that he's the same character and he still has that haunting him. And I think that's why it works so well with these ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, James, I wanted you to have something. You know the tradition? The next one who catches this is the next one who...
No. Thanks, Stella. It's time I left.
Oh, James. Did I see something wrong?
He was married once, but it was a long time ago.
Going back to what we said about the missing ones, every actor, apart from George and Tim, they've had their run. You know, by the end of... Even by the end of You Only Live Twice, you could say, that's fine. You know, we've seen Sean in five brilliant films, in my opinion. We don't necessarily need to have him in any more. I know we got Diamonds and I love that film, but it was a return for the sake of return, wasn't it? Then Roger, by the end, was getting old. We'd seen him, seen him grow. He'd grown into the character. Pierce, yes, I would have liked him to do more, but four films is a good return. And he would have been in his 50s, wouldn't he, by the time?
In that short period of time as well.
Yeah. It whizzed along, but I suppose we were teenagers then, I was. It felt longer maybe when we were growing up. And then, of course, Daniel Craig had nearly two decades. No, well, it's still going on, isn't it? So it's only really, because George is a one-off, that film, there's only Tim who I think has got the real unfinished business to me. Mm. And it's also because of that five-year gap. Okay, nowadays, 5 years is a nice little break, isn't it, for them? But 5 years then was a massive gap without a Bond film.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Lazenby, you saw what he was going to bring to the role. He found it. I really like his performance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I love it. And I think you got a sense of what he was going to do with the role. And would have sort of assumed that he would have done the same, similar things moving forward. But with Dalton, there was still a question of what is that chemistry? What do we get next? Yeah. Because part of his performance was dictated by the plot. Once you've got a revenge plot, you can have lighter moods for your hero, but they're a little bit in the revenge mode, and that dictates your performance or Dalton's performance.
It'd be really interesting to see him in a sort of, in inverted commas, a more normal mission with perhaps, Pushkin could have returned.
Oh.
You still have had Desmond Llewellyn. Caroline Bliss would have still been there.
Robert Brown
as M. Felix Leiter, perhaps. I quite like that's the end arc for David Hedison's Felix Leiter. So, and Felix, it doesn't need to be in every film anyway. But just to see him interact with those characters and then, who knows, someone like Anthony Hopkins as the baddie. I know these aren't even... Well, Anthony Hopkins is someone who's features prominently, doesn't he, in Lost Bond Adventures. It's something that will always nag me, but John's put me at peace now, saying that...
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. I think we got the projects that we were meant to get.
Oh, it's so exciting, isn't it?
What writing project is next for you?
I'm working on something. I'm working on two things now that I'm not quite ready to talk about. I'm always working on something.
Yeah. Okay. Is this going to be like a 10-year project or something a little...
Gosh, I hope not. It's intended to be a 2-year project.
Is it fifth part of franchises?
It is.
I'll be up for that.
Hey man, well, real pleasure to meet you and a real fan of your work, and I really look forward to adding the new book to my coffee table, the Edlitz coffee table possibly.
Right, well, thank you, Mark, very much for joining us.
I'm really delighted to be here. Thank you all for taking the time to talk to me. I had a lot of fun, and So thank you.
No, thank you. Great to talk to you. Great to talk to someone who loves the films we love and has done just terrific research on all the books. And I'm going to get a copy of The Dalton Monk because I've not read that yet. But I absolutely love Movies Go Forth. As Rob said, you can see your love of movies as you turn the pages. So thank you for the work you've done. It's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for everything you shared. Really, really excited. And I cannot wait to read The Lost Adventures of Austin Powers.
You might have to write that one. Really, the worst.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.